I just wanted to comment before I start that one of the reasons there's so many Tar Heels in this group is because North Carolina is a perfect laboratory for the United States. It has mountains, prairies, oceans, west with foam. We have a pretty good similar distribution of racial groups. We have about the average immigration rate, and we're just about average on breastfeeding now and many other factors. So this is why North Carolina has come into this issue so loudly, perhaps. There's no conflict of interest, since I'm not talking about any products. I'd like to thank two people in this room, actually, who have encouraged my interest in reproductive rights and justice. And I have to thank the Barker Institute and David Barker, who spoke last night, for providing some of the fodder that I'm going to build upon. I'd like to describe David's hypothesis. How many of you heard him speak last night? Okay, sorry for the little bit of a review. Then discuss the logic of extending it from a nutrition argument into a reproductive health argument, extending the hypothesis, and then list specific areas of international preventive health where we might encourage change in social justice thinking. So briefly, what is the Barker hypothesis? Well, let me start by what it's done. The hypothesis has really driven public health thinking on early intervention for later chronic disease to be concentrated on nutrition of the fetus, with a little bit give in either direction, but entirely a nutritional argument. It posits that reduced fetal growth is strongly associated with and a determinant of a number of chronic diseases. And that's been a large argument in the nutrition community for why chronic disease dollars and thinking must concentrate on fetal nutrition. And I really don't have any argument with that. Chronic disease needs to look back into prevention. There's two closely related theories, a thrifty genotype and the thrifty phenotype, which means that if you're born little and ready and feisty, you're gonna make it. But then if you're suddenly exposed to overfood and such, things get messed up. So that's a Miriam's interpretation of the whole science. But what the data they use propends to show is that all of this is predetermined predominantly by fetal nutritional status. Okay, they use the term nutritional programming. That variation in quality or quantity of nutrients consumed during the pregnancy can permanently affect the developing fetus, and the causal pathway is correct, that the development of cells is mediated by the nutrients available as those cells are developing. So there is no question that there is a nutrient mediation in the development of these cells that is important. But it's then suggested that, therefore, the genetic interpretation of cells has only to do with nutrients present, that the genetic interpretation and expression only has to do, or predominantly has to do, with what nutrients are present and not much else. And this is what I would like to debate a little bit. I keep hitting the wrong direction, sorry. So let's explore this. Few of the studies that were used to defend this hypothesis control for other variables that we in this room consider pretty important, like non-nutrient exposures, health issues, during the preconception and interconceptional periods, do not take into account breastfeeding, and they do not take into account other childhood periods that get very far away from that prime period. So if one accepts this hypothesis, it would perforce limit prevention of chronic disease to one time and one issue, fetal nutrition. This posits that future health is set in utero and by nutrition alone. And frankly, this discourages chronic health prevention thinking from looking beyond that. So my rationale for expanding the hypothesis is that there are factors that go beyond present nutrients during pregnancy, and that the preconception, interconceptional periods, and the postnatal period of the reproductive health continuum are vital aspects of setting up this are vital aspects of preventing later chronic disease. And we can base that, and I'd like to base it today, on some physiological and developmental evidence and arguments. So in the end, I would like to reframe the issue with chronic disease to be one of reproductive health continuum rather than intrauterine nutrition alone. Thank you in the back for the segue. So let's look at the preconceptional period, first of all. Can we impact birth? Let's say birth weight is a major indicator of later chronic disease. But let's take it outside of the fetus and the fetal nutrients. Can we impact birth weight by interventions that occur during the interconceptional period, part of the reproductive health continuum? And in this Cochrane review, frankly, they only found one study that bothered to look beyond preconceptional interventions that bothered to look throughout the pregnancy so that we could actually see what happens at the end of the pregnancy. And in this study, they found that preconceptional health only really impacted on one indicator, which was birth weight. How handy. Birth weight is the central theme of the Barker hypothesis. So what we find is that, yes, indeedy, the reproductive health continuum is a time for intervention, even if you accept the birth weight hypothesis as being the primary hypothesis. The authors of this article concluded, there is currently insufficient evidence to recommend widespread implementation of routine pre-pregnancy health promotion for women of childbearing age, either in the general population or between pregnancies, because there was only that one study. However, because there was one study, this provides rationale for intervention in the preconception period to impact birth weight. So again, they say you can't have a whole bunch of impacts during the preconceptional period. Now, I would argue that, but I'm simply sharing what the Cochrane database said. They did say the one thing you can impact on is birth weight. So these are the areas of study that have been used to defend the Barker hypothesis. By the way, I met David before it became the Barker hypothesis. I met him at Hopkins and then at WHO, and he's been very clear and has been gathering the defense for his hypothesis ever since. And these are the main areas that he mentions, also osteoporosis, but we can talk about that. He has clear evidence that when you look at his indicator, the birth weight indicator, or peri-birth weight indicator, you will find statistical correlation, and he can develop an argument that it impacts coronary heart disease, hypercholesterolemia, high blood pressure and stroke, diabetes, obesity, and breast cancer. Now, all of us is everybody here been studying the breastfeeding literature? Does that look like a familiar list? There's very clear data that breastfeeding, even controlling for birth weight, impacts on all of these. Now, I don't have the money or resources available yet to actually show the relative strength of each. But I do want to point out that these entities are significantly impacted by breastfeeding, regardless of birth weight. So I think logically, if we're going to explore this, we can't look at these as two separate things. We have to control for one or the other. There have to be more studies that go through the continuum so that we really can look at the relative weight of these interventions. Now, there's a certain illogic of assuming that effects stop at birth, because the human being really is still a fetus for a good period of time after it's born. Because we have these stupid big heads, we have to pop out early. And when you compare us to other mammals, it's been posited that human beings really shouldn't be born for another 6 to 12 to even 24 months after when they're being born now, to reach the maturity that other mammals have. So much like the kangaroo, human beings were meant to crawl up and latch onto the breast and not leave it for a goodly period of time. Because this is what the kangaroos do, and they do quite well, thank you. So the postpartum period of care is physiologically, in the human, inseparable from the physiological milieu of pregnancy because we pop out early. And there is increased recognition that chronic disease outcomes can be modified in the postnatal period. So again, Barker has begun to expand his hypothesis into the postnatal period, but again, it's still a nutritional hypothesis. In the discussion of his hypothesis that was published a few years ago, there was increased recognition of this period. And the comment was made that these relationships that are established by birth weight and in utero can be modified by patterns of postnatal growth. Now, they indicate that the growth is that the growth per se, nutrients available, cause epigenetic modification. And that's why the hypothesis can continue. Well, I really do feel that the point of my whole study, I've been trumped by this study that just came out that says, guess what? Human milk, regardless of nutrient value or anything, changes gene expression. Human milk, breastfeeding human milk, modifies not only the genes that are there at the moment it passes through the guts, but also modifies regulatory genes. It is not the nutrient components of breast milk that does this. It doesn't matter on the nutrient level of the breast milk, but there are other factors in human milk that mediate gene expression. To me, this kind of puts the nail in the coffin of nutrients only, because this shows that it is not nutrients only that mediate the expression of genes that you'll have throughout your life, but indeed it's aspects of human milk and breastfeeding. So, has this argument allowed us to expand the hypothesis and to have increased attention to reproductive rights and justice? I would say in summary that there is now a clear defense that interventions in the interpregnancy interval and during breastfeeding that are not necessarily nutrient-based but could be health-based or reproductive health-based contribute significantly to the reduced risks of occurrences of the same diseases that make the argument for the Barker hypothesis, and that breastfeeding contributes significantly to these reduced risks. And we have a biologically plausible argument to continue this discussion that it goes beyond nutrients available alone, and that the reproductive health continuum is a mediator of chronic health. Again, here yet another study trumped me. This one just came out. It's ahead of print. And it said, and I'm going to read it because this is what I would have liked to say, but I don't have these big words. The window of developmental plasticity extends from preconception to early childhood and involves epigenetic responses to environmental changes which exert their effect during life history phase transitions. So these folks said it before me. This is actually an international group, so I don't mind being trumped by Euro. And what they're saying is that it's not just the nutrient availability in utero, but this plasticity, this ability to change throughout the reproductive health continuum has a real impact on later chronic disease. They say that it could be transmitted transgenerationally and go on to say we really must look more at these epigenetic consequences that may allow us to develop novel and curative measures. So to conclude, just to summarize, I believe, and I hope you believe with me now, that the evidence available on the interpregnancy interval and on postnatal, especially breastfeeding, compared to the nutritional status argument alone, we can at least say that they're equally important for chronic disease prevention. We can say that those that happen outside of nutrient available to the fetus are perhaps more amenable to intervention, and that these should be included in the development of an evidence-based extended hypothesis. So, I feel that it becomes fair to contend that chronic disease support must now recognize the importance of the reproductive health continuum, and I think this adds for us a new support framework for reproductive rights and justice in terms of its impact on chronic disease, not just on the health of mothers and children in that moment. Let's see, Doug, you're not really a graybeard, but hopefully this argument will help some of the graybeards out there recognize that reproductive health is not just an issue for those mothers and children out there, but also is an issue for every man, woman, and child as they go throughout their life. Thank you very much.
You get, no, there's time for questions. So, do we have questions for
Mary?
Thank you so much.
Interesting combination of ideas. One of the things I wonder is, yesterday Barker talked about the multiple generations involved in the process and how something happening to the grandmother affects the mother and then that affects the grandchild. Do you think there might be a similar thing happening at the level of the breast development? We have, we know there's a huge variation in women's ability to produce milk. Levels of fat, for example, I don't know much beyond that. But would addition or production volume?
As you were speaking, I had three ideas. Let me see if I can reclaim them in response to that. One is that, you know, biblically speaking, everybody says unto the fourth generation, you know, why has the human race, the Greeks said this too, unto the fourth generation, why have we always thought it takes four generations to create change? I mean, this has been in the human gestalt for a very, very long time. And I think that you might be hitting upon it. As Barker, I'm sure he said last night, and as we know, the major predictor of birth weight was mom's birth weight. But that's without much intervention. And now that we are clear that the epigenetic intervention, if you will, the lovely studies done also in North Carolina at Duke on the agouti mice have shown very clearly that a certain change in the expression of genes in one generation definitely can go on to the next generation. Sorry, Mendel, but we have now learned that Mendelian genetics just doesn't always hold, and that there are environmental exposures, probably more than we like to think about, that are affecting us through several generations. In terms of breast size and such, we have really, for hundreds and hundreds of years, messed with evolution, if you will, by finding ways to feed babies when the mom can't. So the mother's breast size, certainly there's some genetic hand down of everything in our bodies, but we also have found ways to cope when moms can't produce enough milk. There's been wet nurses, there's been other things done. So I don't know how much we know that as a species, we probably have slightly higher problems with breastfeeding than wild mammal species do. It's illogical. Somebody did the math that a wild species couldn't logically have more than 1 in 1,000 breastfeeding failure without getting major shift over several generations. And we see a breastfeeding failure that's higher than that, partly because we've learned how to cope, and perhaps because of epigenetic changes that we can't even begin to account for. So I think those were the three points that you helped me to think about. Big questions.
Yeah, I was thinking of it partly, and if I remember his argument, he talked about the placenta not being capable of making certain transport functions adequate and so on. So if you think of the breast as sort of the analogous nutrient delivery intermediate between the mother and the baby, you could
undo a lot of that problems. And probably that's what we're seeing in all this literature that shows, regardless of birth weight, that breastfeeding does have these long-term consequences. It's probably because we're still fetuses when we're being breastfed. And so this is an extended fetal hypothesis, perhaps. I don't know.
We have time for one more question. Yeah.
I'm just curious, who was the author on the first article you
mentioned? Oops. The very first one?
Yeah, the one where...
Oh, I wish I had the kind of mind that could... Is this the one?
No, I think it was one after that. That was separate.
Which what was the topic of the article?
No, it was when you were talking about the breast milk factors that mediate gene expression.
Oh, the very last one? That was... The Hochberg study, the new one about gene expression. One before that was Chapkin and Zhao. I can share this with you later. Anybody who wants it, I'd be happy to share the reference list. Okay, thank you for allowing me this.
Yeah, sure, one question.
Sure.
May I miss it? Breastfeeding, what? Exclusive breastfeeding for 2 years? What is breastfeeding here in all of these?
Good question. I have to say, if the studies were good enough to distinguish that, I'd be able to do it better, too. But there's very few studies that sufficiently define breastfeeding, and those that do define it a whole bunch of different ways. So when I say that studies have shown that breastfeeding impacts on all those diseases, it's been a variety of kinds of breastfeeding. Some are ever never, some are at least 3 months, some are at least 6 months, and so on.
And one last thing, given that I was your student some time ago, although
we're
the same age.
We were.
I invite you to come to Haiti because I've been tracking a computerized health information system for 100,000 people, exclusively breastfed, tracked.
And you have their birth weights too?
And birth weights. And now those girls are now pregnant.
Now, okay, confession, Betty got me through epidemiology in graduate school. Anyway, I'll be there. Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you all very much.
You.